Greetings, everyone. I'm Mike McQueen, your friendly teacher librarian, and welcome to Reading on the Run. I'm here with Kelly Gallagher, author and educator. Kelly, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. That book has kind of struck a nerve in a good way, I think, in a lot of people. I think the time is right for the message of that book, and you know, the idea that we're losing a lot of readers, and there are many reasons for that. But I also believe that school actually kind of plays a role in that.
Yeah, exactly. I have a couple questions about struggling readers, but before we get into that, first, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself as an author, and then maybe tell us a little bit about that book in particular?
Well, sure. I am a high school English teacher. I teach in Anaheim, California at Magnolia High. As we're conducting this little chat, I'm actually sitting at my desk in room 301. My last period just left, so I'll apologize if there are any announcements or bells that ring in the background.
No worries.
I'm in the end of my 25th year, not that I'm counting, but there's 7 days of school left. And I'm still really interested. I've always been very interested in adolescent literacy. I never really set out in my teaching career with the idea that I would eventually write a book or two, but here I am now 25 years later, and I have now written 5 books on adolescent literacy. The book you're referring to, Read Aside, is my last release book. I have a new book on writing coming out in October of 2011. But Read Aside is the most recent book that's out, and in that book I discuss, you know, a concern that I've seen in my own classroom over the years, and that is, it seems that as each subsequent year goes by, my high school students are less likely to be recreational readers, less likely to go to the library, less likely to want to read for fun.
And with that topic, a lot of the stuff that I read in your book addresses struggling readers of basically all ages. I mean, I know that book particularly addresses standardized testing, which is typically upper elementary all the way through high school. But a lot of the issues that you address cover readers even younger, all different types of struggling readers too, not just, you know, kids that maybe have disabilities, but kids that have the wrong attitude and, you know, all sorts of struggling readers. So with that book, have you gotten a big response from it already?
Yes, the book has received quite a large response, a number of journals, a number of interviews like this one, a number of parents. I've heard from lawmakers. As I said, you know, it seems more than ever that reading is in crisis mode, and I think that the message of the book, you know, really struck a nerve in people who are very, very concerned that our kids are losing the desire to read recreationally.
Right. Okay. Let's start with the first question. Why are high interest materials important to struggling readers? So the next few questions are really going to address the importance of supporting interests in our kids with reading. So why are, you know, high interest materials so important?
Well, I think high interest reading materials is important to all readers, but particularly so for struggling readers. The problem is, because I think the testing demands, the demands of the tests and the consequences of kids scoring low on tests has become so intensified that most of the reading that kids are now being asked to do in school is academic in nature. And I am a proponent of academic reading. I do believe that kids should read, rich academic texts. You know, I want my ninth graders to read Romeo and Juliet or my 12th graders to read Hamlet. But I also believe very, very strongly that kids should be encouraged to read recreationally, should be encouraged to read, you know, goofy and fun and not so serious kinds of reading, you know, the kind of reading that John Sheska calls stupid reading.
Right.
And that's the kind of reading that I think is really foundational to building a lifelong love of reading. And at the same time, although it's foundational, I think it's being put on the back burner, or in many cases, it's actually being taken off the stove completely as the pressures mount on schools and teachers to raise the reading score, raise the reading score, raise the reading score. And, you know, I like to read, but if I look at the kind of reading activities that schools have asked my ninth graders to do over the years, I don't think that I would like reading very much either. These kids have come into my classroom and, you know, they're kind of at the point, they were in kindergarten when No Child Left Behind was passed, and they've now come to believe that the reason you should read is to prepare for a test. Well, I'm getting ready to go off to summer vacation, and I'm excited because I have 10 or 12, 15 books that I have stacked and ready for my attention. Not one of them is academic in nature, you know. It's not the kind of reading we do as lifelong readers, and yet I think schools have lost sight of that.
And high interest, what would you define as high interest?
Well, I mean, things, you know, John Sheska, I mean, he says kids should be reading, you know, Captain Underpants. Kids should be reading about gross stuff. They should be reading, they should be reading about boogers. They should be reading, you know, and as they get older, they should be reading about things that interest them. I like reading crime fiction, but crime fiction isn't taught in school, which is probably a good thing because if they taught it, they'd probably ruin it. But there's a lot of different kinds of reading that I think is really high interest that schools traditionally do not value. I think the younger kids are in school, the more likely it is they will get, you know, exposure to kind of fun, interesting, you can read on your own kind of books. But I think the older kids get, the higher they climb the ladder, you know, K-12, I think it's less likely that they're going to find teachers who really work hard on developing the recreational reading side of their reading development, and that's a shame.
And I would say typically third grade is when most standardized testing kicks in, and from my experience, and I was elementary librarian for 10 years, and that's basically when I saw that tapering off of smothering kids with stuff that's really interesting to them, and kids, you know, the focus of improving their reading skills and everything, and, you know, and I think parents and teachers, it's probably both that lose sight of the importance and the value of tailoring to their interests.
Yeah, I think in third grade, you know, that is kind of the traditional turning point for a lot of kids, although I have seen a lot more test prep in K through 2 than certainly was ever there before. If you look at the national studies, you'll see that the biggest drop-off of reading generally occurs around the age of 13. So, you know, it's interesting that third and fourth and even fifth graders, when asked, will often say they see themselves as readers. But those same kids, when you ask them in eighth and ninth grade, have come to a point in their life where they don't see themselves as readers anymore. So something sort of gets in the way of that development, and it seems to happen, you know, upper elementary, junior high school age.
Right, and I think as kids get older too, their, you know, their interest in things change, and some of the things that they read, they maybe even read certain things, but they just don't think it counts as reading, which leads me to my next question. I'm going to jump to the third question. Why is it important to have a mixture of reading materials? Why is that important to struggling readers? Like, what are different types of materials, and why is it important that parents and teachers support the different types of materials?
Well, kids are coming of age now in a world where there isn't one type of reading material. I mean, kids should be reading all different kinds of things. I think, for example, young kids should be reading comic books. They should be reading magazines. They should be reading blogs. They should be reading websites. The kinds of reading that you're going to have to do, you know, as an adult to be a proficient reader. I'm not suggesting that a kid should read a website that's really geared for older kids or young adults. But that kid should be given a real wide diet of reading, because it's been my experience in talking with many teachers across the country that they are not getting a real wide diet of reading experiences in some of the classrooms that they're in. So, you know, this notion of being a literate human being means that you know, that kids should have access to a wide variety of genre, a wide variety of even delivery systems, you know, online or a tablet or, you know, hold in your hand a comic book or a magazine. But kids who are real reluctant readers, more than anybody else, need a variety of kinds of reading, because they probably, you know, the less you read, the less you are developing your background and prior knowledge. And when you get up into secondary school, lack of prior knowledge and background becomes, in my opinion, the largest reading impediment, the largest reading issue. I have kids in my classroom who can read the words. They can phonetically sound them out. They have enough fluency that they can read them, you know, quickly enough and still have room to think about what they're reading. But they don't comprehend what they're reading because they don't have any prior knowledge and background to tie the text to. So, you know, if you don't know that Joe Biden is the Vice President of the United States and you're asked to read something about Joe Biden, you might struggle. So I think if we have any chance to build strong readers, that begins by giving developing readers as much varied reading experiences as possible. I hear some schools, for example, they take struggling readers and they say, whoa, this kid can't read very well, so let's limit his science and let's limit his history and let's limit his art and give him double and triple reading time. I really think that's a backwards approach. I think the kid needs twice as much history, twice as much art, twice as much science, so that when he actually gets to read things, he has the prior knowledge and background and experience to understand the words that are on the page. I find with my students, the kids who struggle the most with reading are the kids who had the narrowest reading background. And so, again, as a parent or as a teacher, I think the task is to put as much different kinds of reading in front of the kids as possible.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's one of the things that so many parents and teachers just misunderstand. They don't understand that. You know, they think that, oh, why are you reading that comic book? You know, get a real book. And they worry so much that their kids aren't going to become good at reading. So they, you know, mistakenly narrow down what they give their kid or allow their kid to read. And I see it all the time. And a good example is like in book fairs. I was just in my daughter's book fair, and I saw a parent, you know, tell his daughter, you know, put that back and get a real book. And I think it was a graphic novel, it was a comic book or something that was very light and fun reading. And I saw her big, you know, her big smile went from a happy, excited, yeah, look at this book, I want to get this book, to, oh no, you know, that doesn't count. And, you know, it was just sad. And I've seen that so often, not with just parents, but with teachers as well. I just think there's a misunderstanding that the importance of that mixed materials.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting study done in that field. For example, in comic books, you know, they've actually done studies where they look at, you know, what kind of exposure you're getting vocabulary-wise for example, number of rare words. Because the way you build your vocabulary is that you read and read and read, and the thinking is that when you're exposed to a word that you don't know, that generally, you know, depending on how strong or how weak the context is, that we learn unfamiliar words incrementally. So you might see a word the first time and not truly understand it, and then you see it a second time or a seventh time or a tenth time, and eventually if you see that word enough, you're going to acquire ownership of it. And so the key, I think, is to have kids read a varied amount of different kinds of material, because you want your kids exposed to unfamiliar words. Now, of course, you don't want the reading to be so unfamiliar that they can't get through it. But, you know, we always want our kids to read things that present them with unfamiliar words. In one study I talk about in my first book, Reading Reasons, they look at the number of rare words that the reader meets, you know, per thousand. And they actually find comic books are a richer source of vocabulary than most adult books. And so if you can get your kid to read a lot of comic books, first of all, that's going to be a stepping stone. It's going to be a gateway. You know, I remember when my daughters read Goosebumps, you know, I didn't think they were particularly well written. They were formulated.
Right.
But my kids love them. And,
yes.
You know, and that took them up to the next level. And the same thing with comic books, you know, that
yes.
comic books and magazines and newspapers, all three of those often have richer vocabulary than traditional books. And so I think it's really important that kids get practice in all different discourses. If I were a librarian like you, I certainly would have a ton of comic books in my budget permitting. I would have a ton of comic books.
Right. Yep. Well, and with the importance of supporting, you know, the interest in a kid, the Goosebumps, that's another common thing I saw all throughout the years in elementary was, you know, people worried about, oh, that's a bunch of crap. You know, that's not really that good for, you know, to build your reading skills and everything, but it definitely is. Okay, let's talk about, I'm so sorry, what were you going to say?
There are stepping stones.
Yes.
So even if you as an adult don't think they're the most quality, high-quality literature, it's a stepping stone to your kid getting to the high-quality literature.
Yes, exactly. And let's talk now about SSR or DEER, sustained silent reading, or drop everything and read, like independent reading time. Tell me about what your thoughts are with that in school and at home.
Well, I think in this age of testing, SSR is sort of being shoved out. It's being seen as not academic enough or I don't know, not test preppy enough. But I strongly disagree with that attitude. I think if a kid's going to become a reader, he or she needs three things. He or she needs a book to read that's interesting, time to read it,
right,
and a place to read it. Now, for some of my kids, the only place where all three of those factors intersect is at school. Some of my kids have a place to read at home, but they don't have time because they leave school and they go to soccer practice and they have to do their homework and do this and that. My kids have the time to do it, but they don't have the place to do it because they share an apartment with a brother or, you know, a large family.
Right.
And so it seems to me that the only place where those three factors, we can be assured that those three factors come together is at school. And reading is a skill. You have to do it to get better at it, much like swimming or shooting a basketball. So the problem, I think, with SSR is that the older, you know, when you get up into middle school and high school, it's very easy to kind of start a program like that, but it's very difficult to maintain it because somebody on that campus needs to kind of carry the flag and come back and remind the faculty repeatedly why we're doing this and why it's important. And, you know, I do a lot of that with my faculty where I share studies and research that support, you know, this idea. I mean, it's very clear. The kids who read the most read the best.
Right.
The kids who read the least read the worst. I mean, to me, it is a testing issue. But it also, I think one of the reasons why SSR struggles in a lot of schools is because I don't think that schools particularly often do a very good job of making sure that kids are surrounded by high-interest reading materials. I talk to teachers around the country, and I often ask them, you know, when was the last time in a faculty meeting you guys sat around and really had a substantial talk on whether your kids have access to really interesting books? And sometimes that question elicits laughs. We've gotten to a point in schools where everything is test, 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 and we don't spend any time as a faculty working with this idea or wrestling with this idea of putting interesting books around our kids. And I believe very strongly that every school should have places on their campus that are, you know, book flood areas, and not just the library. Of course, the library is super important, but I think classrooms should also have books in them. So if a kid reads a Goosebumps book in my classroom and gets interested in the series, then he can go to your library and he can check out 10 more of them. But I don't think there's enough focus, especially in secondary schools, on surrounding kids with high-interest reading materials. It's all pretty much focused on traditional curricular stuff.
Well, one of the things I know that you address in your book is the just overload of standards and curriculum that's required by teachers. And I think most teachers would say that. That's why they have so many things that they have to teach and prepare for through the curriculum, and then also preparing for the tests, that, you know, they only have so much time in the day and they got to give up something. And usually, you know, independent reading time is what is given up. And the problem with that, you know, well, you tell me, what's the problem? What do you see with the problem with that when they have to give? Because I can see many teachers realistically saying, hey, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, help me, give me some advice. What would you tell them?
Yeah, I get that. But, you know, so what? The kid passes the test in the spring and 10 years from now doesn't read another book. What have we accomplished in that approach? So
right.
I would answer a couple things. Number one, in the last 10 years of No Child Left Behind, reading scores have not dramatically improved. They've in some places, they've even fallen. In some areas, they've flatlined. So, first of all, I don't think that the test approach is working. And secondly, in the course of it not working, it's actually a double whammy, because it's not working and it's making kids dislike reading. And I don't think it has to be an either or. I think if you get your kids to read a whole lot more recreationally, I actually think they will read better when they get to the state tests or the district tests, the schools, you know, pre and post tests. I don't think it's an either or. I think if you teach kids to read and write well, you know, they'll do fine on tests. But if you only teach kids to take tests, they'll never read and write well. So that's a tough leap for teachers, because, you know, the scores are printed, you know, there's a lot riding on it. But to me, I try very hard to focus on what's in the best interest of my students. And sometimes, in my opinion, what my school district or any school district wants me to do is not in the best interest of my kids. And so I advocate in Read-Aside that even all the way up through high school, I think half the reading kids do in school should be recreational in nature. Half. But I would venture to guess that in most schools, it's, you know, 100% academic by the 12th grade. And again, I think what that does is it creates test takers who do not like to be, or do not lean towards being lifelong readers.
Okay, let's talk about two more things. The study to read or not to read. I know you mentioned that a little bit in your book, but, you know, it kind of connects with reading for fun. So can you tell us a little bit about that study and the impact with
starting to read or not to read? Was a study came out, I think, in 2007 or 8 that really looked at reading across the country. It had a number of very interesting findings. It found, for example, that the first generation of students who were raised in the sort of electronic media age, they read less, and they read less well than previous generations. They found that internet reading often produces shallower reading than holding a book and really working your way through chapter by chapter. That internet reading kind of leads to a kind of click and go, more of a surface level type of reading than the kind of cognition that is needed to go all the way through a chapter book. To Read or Not to Read found that college students are now beginning to read less proficiently than college students did just a few years ago. And, you know, that the number of students who read below basic levels of reading is growing. And so, again, I think it was a study that really underscored the state of the state of reading, and that the fact that reading's not heading in a good place.
And what do you think, what are some of the suggestions or implications for struggling readers with, you know, based off of that study?
Well, the problem is the world is changing. You know, when I was in high school, you could drop out and be an auto mechanic, and that would not have been a problem. Today, unskilled labor is disappearing. I mean, to be an auto mechanic,
right,
a car has onboard computers, it has a mile and a half of wiring, it has all kinds, you know, you have to have a level of sophistication that you, reading computers, and there's a lot to be said about developing your skills as a rider that were not necessary you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, this idea that kids can kind of just read about the same level that they've always read is really not true when you think that the demands, the reading demands are intensifying. And so our kids are, you know, heading into a global competition, and it's those kids who are going to be able to read at richer and deeper levels who are going to have an advantage on those who can't. And my concern is that unskilled labor is being replaced. It's being replaced by either automation, or it is being outsourced or offshored. And so those jobs that often perhaps may have offered a middle-class way out, a middle-class income, aren't there anymore. And if you look at the fastest growing job fields in the next projected in the next 10 or 20 years, many of them value the ability to read and the ability to write. And so if our kids are sitting in schools all day bubbling in multiple choice tests, I'm afraid, as I say in Readicide, that we are raising multiple choice thinkers in an essay world.
Right. Okay, what last question. What, tell us about the Finland, you know, what's going on in Finland with reading and struggling readers.
Well, Finland has the highest level of reading scores in the world, and you know, I know a lot of that. You got to be careful when you compare internationally like that, because they're much more of a homogeneous population, homogeneous language. But out of the 57 countries that were studied in a recent international reading study, Finnish teenagers finished first. And I don't know, they have a very different approach there. Babies come home from the hospital, they're given books. They have libraries inside their shopping malls. Their children don't even start school until age 7, which I think is very, very interesting, where in the United States our movement seems to be starting kids younger and younger.
Right.
They don't track kids into gifted classes in Finland. They keep them all together, so it's much more of a homogeneous approach to education. And I would just say from a teaching point of view that Finnish teachers are given much more leeway in designing lessons and given much more time to collaborate and think the systematically are treated much more professionally than teachers are in the United States. There was a quote in Readicide where a principal said, you know, in most countries, education feels like a car factory, but in Finland, the teachers are entrepreneurs, and that there's buy-in. And, of course, the most striking contrast in Finland is they do very little, if any, standardized testing. So here's the,
wow,
here's the country with the highest reading scores in the world, and they don't give kids the kind of tests that our kids are drowning in. And so, yeah, I know there are other factors that come into play, but Finland also finished ahead of other countries that had the same characteristics as Finland itself. So I think that's pretty interesting to note as well, that the country that has the highest reading scores in the world do things quite markedly different than we do.
It's fascinating to me because throughout my entire career, that's what I've always felt too, is just, I don't know, it seems like it's more of a laid back, maybe not laid back, but non-pressured situation that they seem to promote. Not saying that that's not as involved or not as caring, you know, but just when you take out the intensity and the pressure of it and give a little bit more ownership to the teachers, you know, I'm sure those are pretty big factors, and it's just so appealing that, I don't know, I just think we have a lot to learn. You know, I know you said too, yeah, it's a good point that they're different and it's a different situation, but I think we as a society, as a country, could learn a lot from how they do things.
I agree, and you know, and if I'm a parent listening to this and my kid is sitting in a school that has reading scores that are dramatically rising, I have to tell you, I'd be a little bit concerned about that, because I'm not sure the right things are being emphasized. You know, what I'd want to know is does my child's school have expectations that my child will read recreationally? Do they support that by giving kids time to read? Do they support that by giving kids interesting books to read, not just academic books to read? Those are kind of the questions that I would ask in looking at my child's school.
You know, that's an amazing point, and something that I guess I never really thought of too much either, because, you know, I think naturally we assume that, you know, high-performing schools and, you know, there's so many involved and caring parents, and they worry so much about their kids becoming good readers, and they see their school as, oh, look at the great test scores, and that's a great thing, and they never probably even stop to think about that point that you just raised, whether or not those kids, if their kids are, you know, developing that love and, you know, building the foundation for reading that's not just skill-orientated, but love, you know, passion-orientated.
Both of my daughters attended very high-achieving high school, and both did very well in high school. But I have to tell you this, the high school came very, very close to extinguishing their love of reading.
Oh, it's so sad. Of course, I'm sure that you have a big influence on their love, so you can kind of guide them back on the right path. That's kind of the same way I look with my daughters. But unfortunately, you know, so many parents don't have that knowledge behind them and that understanding and realization that that's so important. But okay, well, let's wrap it up here. Last question for you, I guess. I did have one more. What advice would you give parents or teachers that have struggling readers? If you could, like, summarize everything, whatever, if you could give one little piece of advice, what advice would that be?
Can't swim in a pool if there's no water in the pool. You got to surround the kids with books, magazines, newspapers, comic books. You have to model yourself. You have to give them a time and a place to read, and you have to just give them access to interesting things to read. I know people want a more complicated answer than that, but I think the younger the kids are when you show them the value of reading, the easier the job becomes. The older they get, and trying to teach a kid who hasn't read for 10 years that reading is really valuable becomes very, very difficult. So start early. You know, there's a lot of studies that show that your level of literacy, that your level of language exposure before you enter kindergarten is a strong indicator of where you will exit the 12th grade. So I would say out of the womb, talk to the child, read to the child, as much language exposure as humanly possible.
Kelly, it was my pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you so much for taking time to share your insights and talk a little bit about your book.
Well, it was my pleasure, and I'd like to say thank you for your websites and everything you're doing to try to promote the love of reading. That's much appreciated by those of us in the trenches.
All right, Kelly. Well, thanks. We look forward to your next book. What's your upcoming book called again?
I have a book coming out in October called Write Like This. It talks about the value of teachers being models and providing kids with models. If we want them to be good writers, we have to show them what good writers do.
All right. Very good. Look forward to checking it out. All right. Take care, Kelly. Thanks
All right.
again.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.